Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
What is happening, podcast human beings? Hopefully your summer is just going splendidly well, because mine is. I'm actually in Washington, D.C. right now, doing a little thing with my family, hanging out here for 2 weeks, working, just doing the whole thing, probably seeing some, you know, sights or what have you. But I am thrilled to bring you a conversation that I had with a friend of mine. Which it's weird to say friend, because this is a band that was so formative, and I cannot put an larger exclamation point to how formative this band was for me and many of my friends. I have Stephen Andrew Miller, the guitarist from Unbroken. He also played in Kill Holiday, played in a band called Crushed on You. He's got some new projects working on, which we talk about towards the end of this particular episode. But yeah, if you don't know Unbroken, do yourself a absolute favor and listen to Life, Love, Regret from front to back, and then listen to their last 7-inch, which is only 2 songs, I was going to say, from front to back. Actually, it's 3 songs, but I just adore this band. And Steve, I've wanted to have on for quite some time. We were actually supposed to connect when he was living out here in Southern California, but he has since departed the state of California, and he lives on the East Coast now. But we finally did it, and I was very glad to have this discussion with him, because Unbroken is playing a reunion show on July 29th to celebrate the 30-year anniversary of Indecision Records, which is awesome. They're doing a whole 2-night thing. I'm fairly certain it's sold out. It breaks my heart, because I actually was planning on going, but then this trip to DC, it's just conflicting, and it's a shame that I don't get to see Unbroken. But fortunately, I have seen them many times, not in their original iteration, but ever since they came back. But yeah, I'm bummed. But you should absolutely go if you have tickets. And obviously, if you don't have tickets, then you know, try to find them on the secondary market. I was about to call it black market, but that's not true. So Steve and I talk a lot about, obviously, Unbroken, his life in and around music. It's really, really fun. So let's get some business done. You have to support Year of the Knife. If you are not familiar, for one, with the band, or two, the horrible situation that they got put in via a van accident, the vocalist Maddie, who I have had on this very podcast many moons ago, she is recovering slash in a coma. She's in critical condition. It's awful. And I've contributed to their GoFundMe, and I know many, many other people have. It definitely feels like the whole broader hardcore slash punk community has rallied around this and are donating a lot of money to them, because we're talking about a catastrophic situation. end to the way that the band can operate right now, and they need all the support that they can. So I will leave a link in the show notes. If you have not contributed, I urge you to do so. 5, 10, 20, whatever it is, please do that. And I know there's a lot of other places, whether it's t-shirt fundraisers, the label that they're on, Pure Noise, is doing some test press auctions. Like, there's a lot of things going on. So please contribute in whatever way you can. And for free, if you want to support this show, you can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can leave a rating on Spotify if that's where you listen. And you can always email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. Love to receive feedback, guest ideas, whatever the case may be. The inbox is open. So let's talk to Mr. Stephen Andrew Miller. We caught up one late afternoon, and it was great, because I ultimately, the fact that will just stick in my brain forever and ever and ever is, like, he thinks that they paid around $800 to record Life, Love, Regret, which is just like, oh my gosh, it's amazing to hear those facts of what we were all, you know, contributing to in the 90s, where it was like, and at one point, $800 for a recording session was like, oh my gosh, like, I can't afford that. It's crazy. So anyways, let's talk to Steve. And of course, at the very end of the episode, I will talk about what's coming up next week. So here is Steve. And like I have told you before, my unapologetic love for your music, not only Unbroken, but just, you know, all the stuff that you have done. And I'm sure it's really interesting for you to not only sit with actual perspective on the band, because it's clearly existed in many different iterations. And then when people like myself come to you and are like, oh my gosh, like, I love your music, and, you know, kind of reflect that back to you. Is it interesting for you to hear that, knowing that, like, you know, most of the ways that people interact with your music, especially with Life, Love, Regret, is that, you know, that was clearly not a fun time for any of you. I mean, it was fun creating it, I'm sure, in certain respects, but, like, you guys were all going through it. So, like, is it interesting for you to be like, I'm glad it's resonant?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to make this part of the thing, I could explain a little bit of that to
absolutely,
because there is an answer to that for sure. Which I don't know if you want, I can give it to you now, or if you want to save it for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would love to hear that
right now.
Sure, absolutely.
So basically, I'm used to it, which sounds very not fair in a sense. I mean, I've heard it so much now to where it's just kind of like, yeah, it's cool. I appreciate it. I'm very respectful of it. But there was a period for a few years after Unbroken, and even right after Kill Holiday, I was very, very turned off by hardcore, and not hardcore as a thing in itself, because I still love the bands that I love, but I was very turned off by the scene. It just wasn't where I wanted to be anymore. And it was turning into something I just hadn't signed up for. It had gone from being punk rock to just brutal and jock, and the music wasn't really anything that resonated with me. So I kind of dipped out of it, and I just played different types of music, hung out with different people. And there was, I think it was probably 2002 or 2003. And someone started talking to me about Unbroken, and they're saying, yeah, it's like cult status. Like, people love your band. And I was like, are you serious? Like, I just didn't know it, because even during Kill Holiday time, it wasn't really Unbroken. It didn't have that same thing that it has when we first did the reunion in 2009. The 98 show for Eric was a big deal. And then I thought that was it. That was the end of it, you know? But I didn't know how to really react or respond when people were making such a big deal about it. And it is kind of, I get it. I mean, I'm fanatical about things too. I can understand when you find something that resonates with you and you relate to it and it speaks to you. And I'm very fortunate. I feel very fortunate that we created something that's timeless, that it's something that every year somebody's discovering this, or it's something that somebody says, hey, you should check this out. Or if you like this, you might be into this, you know?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was just crazy to kind of like reintroduce myself to what was current at the time in hardcore and find out that people actually really did care, and to find out all the bands that were existing at that time saying, yeah, you guys were an influence. You guys are the reason we're doing what we're doing, or one of the reasons why they're doing what they were doing.
Right, right. And I'm sure on top of that, kind of dovetailing off that, the idea that because this record was created during such a tumultuous time in all of your lives, like, you know, I mean, everybody kind of at that age obviously has a lot of different things going on.
Right.
But is that interesting? You know, I know that plays into the resonance of that particular record, but is it also in your head? Is it kind of like, yeah, like I'm really glad that a lot of value was, you know, extracted from it from an artistic perspective, but I can't really explain how hard of a time it was for us.
It's crazy though, because I look at it now. I mean, I'm going to be 48 here in a few months. So it's, you know, we recorded that when I was 18. And when you're a teenager, whatever, you know, struggles you're dealing with, they're the size of giant mountains at that time in your life. It's the most extreme thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And I look back at it and I can't really remember what was wrong. I mean, everybody had their own stuff and it was very fair and relevant to them at the time, but I can't look back and say what was, I don't know how to word that. Cause it totally, I'm not trying to discredit anything that anybody else is feeling or even how it was back then. I don't really remember it being as bad as we portray it being, but it doesn't mean sure. that it wasn't. Cause at the time it was creating, we were creating that music because of it. But I think now I look at things a lot differently and it doesn't feel the same way. You know, it's like, it's kind of like the thing when when you're a parent, your child like falls and hurts himself or something like that. And you're like, ah, come on, get up. It's not that big of a deal. But to him, it's like the most insane thing in the world to be dealing with. And that's kind of what that was like. Like that was, you know, figuring it out. That's the best way I always use to describe it. So we were just figuring it out. We're still kind of, you know, you're developing your identity. You're figuring out who you are. And there's so many things, your first relationships, your schooling, your jobs and your friends. And it's just like, that's really what it is. You're just trying to navigate through everything and emotions run high. And it's just it's a learning experience, I suppose. And it's,
yeah.
I mean, it still is, but you know, so case in point, looking back at it, it's like, yeah, we definitely had issues. I had issues, but I can't remember what they were at this time.
No, totally. And I think that's what is so, even if a person, you know, is just interacting with the music on the record and like not really soaking in any other elements of it, it's that either time capsule of where you guys were at with that, you know, your ages and like your musical tastes and all that sort of stuff. I think to your point, that's why it, you know, sticks to people and it doesn't leave them. It's not just this like transactional record that people, you know, kind of churn through. It's like, no, this is like with me and it, you know, sticks.
I think for me too, and this is getting a little personal, but I think right around the time I turned 40, I hit rock bottom, like emotionally. I was just, I was spent. I don't know. It was just a really tough time and I was trying to get help. I drank too much to try and like kind of medicate and that only made it worse. It definitely did not help me at all. And when we found out, my wife and I found out we were expecting, it was like, okay, that's it. I'm done drinking. And then I don't know. It's like a night and day switch to where everything that was wrong with me just kind of just went away. And I don't know if it was a conscious effort just to say, you know, I'm not going to be that way. Or did I really just stop being that way? But so that's kind of why it's hard to look back at the time and really understand it. Cause now I don't have time to be depressed. Sure. I'm too busy, but B, at the same time, I tend to find ways to rationalize everything now. So if something is going to get me down, I kind of look at it and go, well, why is it getting me down? And what am I going to do about it? And
right.
And that's what I do. I mean, we all have stress. We all have, you know, it's, you know, at this stage of life, there's so many things that can really get you down, but it's like this, you know, getting down doesn't change the fact that there's still obstacles I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And plus, like, as you progress through life, you clearly get more tools in the toolbox to deal with. And, you know, your support system grows larger, even though, you know, at the time, like you're just constantly hanging out with friends and like, you're always around people, but no one can really rely on each other too much during that time because, you know, like to your point, like we're all just figuring it out. Like,
yeah,
we still are at this age, but then even more so at that age, like no one has any idea what they're doing.
There was a line I had in a Quijada song we never recorded in the first version. And it said, what means the world today might not mean a thing tomorrow.
Right.
And I think maybe I knew then, maybe it was like a foreshadow of going, okay, like this is a really big deal right now, but I'll probably get over it. I'll probably move on and this will be so insignificant. You know, it's such a heartbreaker right now, but in a few months or a few days or a few years, I don't know, it just won't even mean a thing.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Everything is life and death and you only get reminded of that with either associating yourself with people that are younger than you and or to, you know, our collective experience of like having children and understanding like, oh yeah, like I remember how crazy that was when I was 5 and I, you know, lost my toy or whatever. It's right. Like, that's a real thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll dive more into that a little bit later, but kind of in a sort of linear fashion, I know you were born and raised in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from what I understand, like a very sort of typical upbringing in regards to, you know, mom and dad in the household. Did you have any siblings or are you an only child?
No, I have a sister. She's almost 3 years younger than me.
Okay, got it. So you were first on the scene, trailblazer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you and your sister close as you guys were like living together?
Oh, yeah.
Or did you grow closer?
Yeah,
okay, got it.
There was a gap, I think, when I was in high school, she's in junior high. And then even when we never went to school at the same time because I went to a 3-year junior high and a 3-year high school. So she was a freshman when I was a senior and still at separate schools. So when she was in high school, I was already graduated and I was doing my thing. And I think at that time, we probably weren't as close. But then when she got out of school, we definitely grew to be closer.
Cool. That's awesome. And I also understand that like your parents were, you know, musical as far as like always listening to music in the house and playing stuff around you. And it seems like that was a natural progression for you caring about music. Did you have to, I guess, kind of, you know, rebel in certain ways being like, okay, this is my parents' stuff and I appreciate them playing that and it's cool. And so like now I got to find my own tastes and, you know, bum them out in certain respects.
Not in rebellion.
Sure.
I think when I found punk, they didn't quite understand it. Especially with the way this is like the end of the 80s. So we were dressing the part too. We were looking very punk rock and, immediately we were very straight edge at the time without fully knowing the full details of straight edge and stuff, but we were very anti anything that wasn't straight edge. And I remember specifically with my dad, like looking at me thinking probably that I was going to experiment or go do drugs. And it was quite the opposite. So I think what happened with the music, they were probably like, what is this? But then realized that, oh, they're not bad kids. They're not getting into trouble. So maybe this isn't that big of a deal. And it didn't last. I mean, funny enough, my dad was very into the Smiths and the Cure and a lot of those things on his own, like had nothing to do with me. It just turns out coincidentally that he found Morrissey on his own and went and backtracked and was like, oh, I like this stuff. And it was kind of a weird, like, oh, you like this stuff? Yeah, I like this stuff, you know?
Right.
My mom is my mom. She was very into her thing with classic rock and stuff. And it kind of never really evolved from there, which is fine. But my dad definitely took on a liking of modern music and what was, you know, he had an open mind, I should say.
Sure.
And yeah, so I mean, no, I never really rebellion because it wasn't like I was just full blown into music they didn't like. My tastes were all over the map. So, I mean, you know, I had stuff in common with them, even if I liked all these other external groups they knew anything about, we still had commonality with like a lot of the bands that they liked that I liked as well.
Sure. Absolutely. And what did they do for a job as you were growing up? And like, was it in the heart of San Diego or were you in kind of like, you know, Vista and outskirts?
No, I was in San Diego proper. But I was, okay. I was on the very edge of the house I grew up in was pretty much the last street in San Diego, in the city of San Diego before it moved into La Mesa and El Cajon.
So, oh, okay. Got it.
So some people might say I lived in East County, but I wasn't down in the hills in the valley like they you know, East County's kind of got a weird reputation in San Diego for you, especially with Dr. Rob and those guys, all the Chula Vista kids. It's very, it's in the boonies. East County's the boonies to those guys. But I was more aligned with like San Diego State, where that is in San Diego.
Okay, got it. And what did your parents do for jobs as you were growing up?
My mom didn't work a lot of the time, and then she just kind of had random jobs. Like she worked at my elementary school when we were going there for a while, and then eventually I think when I was probably junior high or high school, I can't remember. She just got jobs just to occupy time. Mm-hmm. My dad was a civilian contractor for the Navy. So he wasn't in the service, but he was a planner and estimator for them.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And especially too, I mean, that being in San Diego and working in the military makes a whole lot of sense.
Right.
Yeah. And, from as long as I've, you know, known you and spent time, you know, in and around you, you've always seemed, you know, reserved, like definitely not the person that's, you know, kicking down the door and being the proverbial life of the party in a bad way, lampshade on the head guy. Was that kind of always who you were, or was, you know, certain elements of like, oh, I was more outgoing as a kid, and then, you know, whatever, getting into music brought me more out of my shell or whatever. Like what's the journey there?
I don't know, because I watch my son who's about to turn 6 and he's reserved and shy,
sure.
but he's like me in the sense that when you get to know me, I'm not reserved and shy. And everyone, if you ever talk to him who knows me well, knows that I can be a smart ass / hole. I can be very sarcastic. I could pick on you just the same. I've got the same sense of humor as a lot of other people. I'm just kind of like, you know, pick my battles when I, or if I'm comfortable, but yeah, I'm not going to walk into any room and try and dominate it. But if something is there and I see an opportunity, I kind of take it. But yeah, I don't know how I was as a kid. It's something I actually want to ask my mom because of watching my son going, okay, you know, because when he's in school or he's in public, he's very respectful. He's very polite. He's also very quiet. He definitely like will like nudge up to me, you know, in the public space. But we get home, he'll run around with his pants down and say the word butthole and do everything he can to make you laugh. He's always trying to make you laugh. So, which in a way is a lot like me too. I'm definitely one who would run around their pants down and say funny things to you and try and get you laugh as well. So.
Right. Yeah.
Apples and trees. That's the way I always say it. Apples and trees. Like that must be where I was. So that's what I looked like when I was a kid. That's kind of what I wonder.
Our friends at rockabilia.com want you to know that you can get an awesome discount on all of their officially licensed merch by using this promo code 100 words or less. If you have not looked at what Rockabilia has to offer, you go to their website. And, you know, they have a whole line of Slipknot merch they've recently done. They have a really cool Ozzy Osbourne split shirt with Todd McFarlane, I think. I realize I'm like operating off of knowledge when I, you know, read Spawn as a, you know, early teenager. But, you know, legendary comic book artist. He did the art for it. Regardless, rockabilly.com is the place where you can find all of those pieces of merch, plus like 499,000 other items that are all officially licensed. It ships from the Midwest here in the United States of America, and fast and friendly. Customer service is top shelf. I just love supporting this company, and I appreciate all of the support they've given this show. So again, go to rockabilly.com. Use the promo code 100 words or less. It will give you a nice 10% discount, and then you'll ride off in the sunset with a great piece of merch. Thank you very much, Rockabilia.
And would you classify yourself as kind of, I don't know, like, you know, an outdoor kid, you know, into video games? Like, where'd you find yourself spending time as you were, you know, in elementary school and, you know, maybe going into junior high?
I think at that time, you're a mixture of everything because it's the 80s. And
sure.
Definitely rode BMX bikes, definitely was into skateboarding, but also played video games, but not with the obsession that you see kids do it now. I mean, we played, you know, whatever, Atari, and then moved on to, you know, Super Nintendo and those things. But it wasn't like it wasn't an identity thing. We were totally fine with being outside and like skating and just traveling around and doing that. But I was also a bedroom kid too. And I think that definitely, aids in why I picked up music so early and started playing an instrument so early. Cause it was just, you know, I was in my room a lot. I spent a lot of time by myself, by choice. You know, I am an introvert who's trying hard to be an extrovert, like even with my career and my job, like I am an introvert in an extrovert's world. And sometimes it's very hard to do that. And that's kind of, that was me as a kid. I'm still shy. Like I, you know, afraid to use the phone or, you know, don't want to talk to people. Try fronting a band when you don't want to talk. It's like, it's just, yeah, that's kind of where I am. I'm not the outgoing person on a level with strangers, but I am can be an outgoing person when I'm in a comfortable environment with friends and family and stuff.
Sure. Absolutely. And when you started to, I'm guessing like in probably the junior high section is when, and especially probably through BMX is when that more, you know, DIY, like punk hardcore stuff that was clearly, you know, not the radio or maybe your other friend groups were not finding out about. How did that get introduced to you?
That's a good question. So when I was a kid, like the first things I knew, like Def Leppard was like my first favorite band. And that starts when I was like 5 and 6 years old. And my mom was heavily into like Led Zeppelin and Alice Cooper and Black Sabbath. So those things were there. And somehow, and I don't really know how, I think it might've been just the older kids on my street, because we had kids that were into thrash and my next door neighbor was into like British music, like The Cure and Depeche Mode and stuff. And I don't know if that's where I got it from. I kind of feel like it was, because it wasn't, I don't have a distinct memory of someone going, you should listen to this stuff. Just somehow I found it. And, yeah, I just kind of went from there, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And it is tough too, when you are that age and you are just soaking everything in and it's pretty much devoid of context. It's like the delineations are like, oh, I heard it on the radio, or like, I didn't hear it on the radio. Like, yeah, it's not like you understand anything.
But radio and even MTV then was, they were still huge factors on things, especially the radio. We had 91X and it was the alternative radio station, when the word alternative literally meant what it says. Like it was a different world. It wasn't mainstream. None of those things were, you know, top 40 by any means. And a lot of bands were not necessarily on daytime MTV. It wasn't something, you know, that everybody knew about. There was probably a time in your life you could say something about a band and people would be like, what? Who are you talking about? Right. And now, I mean, you can mention like Fugazi or Minor Threat and you get a lot of civilians who would say, oh yeah, I know that. I've heard of that, you know? So it's kind of it's just different decades for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know just in other interviews and cyberstalking of you, I know that school wasn't exactly your thing, but you made a deal with your parents in regards to, like you mentioned, you know, just a little bit ago, where it's like, all right, 3 years of high school and like, I'm out of here. Did you, and you had no desire, I presume, to go to college, right?
Not really. I mean, it was like, it's what's expected of you. And it just, school wasn't hard. I just didn't have fun. I didn't like it.
Right. And what was the, I guess, proverbial life path? Was there an idea that like, oh man, maybe I will go in the Navy because my, you know, dad could get me in there. Like, was there any, pointing in a direction? No.
I mean, some people are lucky. If you're able to figure out what you want to do when you're younger and you settle on that path, good for you. Like it's not an easy thing. We, as people, change our minds all the time. So it's so hard to think of something when you're like 16 and 17 and go, yep, that's my career path, you know?
Right.
And then stick with it. That's a commitment. And, I don't think anybody at that age is really prepared to make that kind of commitment. And I wasn't. People go to college because they think they have to. It's weird when you're experienced or when you're exposed to counterculture, you don't look at what's expected of you as the path you're supposed to go by going to school, going to college, marriage, kids, job, career. Like that's what normal people do. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing,
right?
But people who didn't live like we did, where, you know, punk rock and hardcore and a different circle of friends and different political values and ideals. And, you know, it's, you know, think about being a kid in high school and you declare, I don't eat animals and I don't drink. You're automatically, that makes you like an outcast. You're like, you're automatically not normal. People don't understand that. And so when you have alternative views like that, you don't look at life as, you know, straight on and go, oh, there's, you know, this is the blueprint and this is what I have to follow. So no, I had no idea what I was going to do. I didn't know for years. I still don't know. I mean,
sure.
Every scenario I've been in, you know, is just the way it naturally evolved, you know?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are that way. I think, you know, whatever you do for a career in general, people, you know, you kind of just fall into it. I think, some people prepare, some people plan, some people go to school for it. And other people just kind of end up where they, you know, they land where they end up, you know?
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. You're totally right. And I know that you started bands, you know, you started to play like in whatever the high school age and, nothing, you know, officially got off the ground really until, you know, Unbroken was probably what you would ostensibly call your first quote unquote serious band, I imagine.
Yeah. I started playing guitar when I was 8, and in junior high, we messed around a lot. Me, Todd, and Eric, especially, and Cliff, who was the first guitar player in Struggle. And we were trying to just figure it out from being like punks and goths and all that, being in the Smiths and whatnot, and trying to do like those kind of bands and loving the Sex Pistols too. And then it kind of just evolved. So yeah, by the time high school hit, I was doing Unbroken. And then I also played in this band called Julia at the same time.
Oh yeah.
During high school times. And so, yeah, it's kind of both happening at the same time.
Right. Especially too, because like Julia was definitely one of those bands too, where, I mean, San Diego, and I'm sure that you were aware of how diverse of a scene it was, where it was like so much going on, mm-hmm. where it's like all of the, you know, foundations that were being laid for, you know, metallic hardcore, emo, indie rock, whatever, you know, rock, like so much was happening. But, you know, at that time you were just playing it because of the sort of instinct that was happening.
It was just normal. I mean, it's probably weird to look at, especially like, you know, with Eric Allen too, the same trajectory of like to be in bands that were on Ebullition or Bloodlink or, you know, just the counterculture, even within hardcore labels. And yet we were also in a band on New Age Records. So it was kind of like, you know, but that's San Diego though. That there was no like, oh, well you're part of that scene. It was just one big scene because every single person in San Diego, and this goes back to bands like Rocket, Jehu and all the stuff they were in, they all came from the punk and hardcore scene, all of it. So, So to say like, oh, well there's this one and that one and this one, they all came from the same origin. And that's just the way we kept it. I mean, you know, San Diego had bands that probably didn't necessarily fit. Pitchfork played a lot of hardcore shows, but was Pitchfork a hardcore band? Not at all. And that kind of carried on into the next wave where it was like, you know, well, there's this type of band and there's this type of band, but they're all on the same bill. And nobody thought, why are they playing together? That was just normal to us, you know? And we kind of, when we first started going on tour and you get to a show and you have like four bands that all sound like one band, just the whole show is like one long song. It definitely opened our eyes to what we had at home to go, oh, there's so much more diversity where each band has so much individuality and brings a lot to the table and dresses differently from one another. Or, you know, it's just kind of just, yeah, it was just a lot of mixed things in one city, which definitely made for, good people to kind of just figure out. I don't know.
Just
a lot to pull from.
Totally. And like, I think it's also exciting, you know, I lived in San Diego for 1 year, but it was just like, you know, existing, you know, just at like, from a sort of graduating class perspective, where it's like when I first started to get into, you know, punk and hardcore in like the mid 90s, just based on my age, it was definitely one of those things where just looking at San Diego and then starting to see all of these splinters of scenes coming off, it was like, oh wow. Whereas, you know, now the internet has flattened every scene and it's really difficult to kind of pinpoint where bands come from, right, based off of, you know, a myriad of reasons. But it was so cool to peel back that layer of onions in regards to what was happening in San Diego, where it's like, oh, this person played this band, did this and this, and like just it keeps going.
Where did you live? What part of the city?
I just went to San Diego State for a year.
I lived in Del Cerro in San Carlos, which is literally the exit is my exit on the north side of the 8 freeway. So, you know exactly where I grew up.
I absolutely do. Yeah. Yeah. It was, I enjoyed that experience living down there, but definitely was like, well, you know, I don't even know why I'm going to college, cause I just want to play in a band. So
yeah,
you know how that goes.
That's the case. I mean, going back to the earlier question, like, I didn't have a pipe dream of being a successful major label rock star. That was never on my radar. If it happened, it happened naturally, but it was never like, oh, we got to do this. We had just, cause if that were the case, the bands I was in would have worked a hell of a lot harder than we did. We didn't put in those kind of hours to do that. So that was never really like, oh, that wasn't a thing.
Right.
So yeah,
that wasn't the path. On that similarish topic, you know, I know, and this is something that you've articulated before, where a lot of people can clearly see the difference between, you know, Ritual and Life, Love, Regret, mm-hmm. and Ritual, you know, for all of its warts and all, where it's like, oh yeah, there's elements of it that are cool, but the record isn't that good, you know? Right. And I think it's interesting where, when you start to get into a band and you start to listen to records just because like, it's like, oh wow, I like this thing, so I'll go backwards, or maybe they have a 7-inch and you just are like, oh, this isn't as good as the other one. And you can't really pinpoint why, but you're just like, I don't like this as much as the other one.
Yeah, I can pinpoint why.
Right, right. I'm sure you can, but I know there wasn't really a question contained in that, but just the idea that you can, you know, you can honestly look at a record and be like, oh yeah, like I see what we were trying, but like, it's not that good of a record.
Well, you know, a really good example of that would be something like maybe like Radiohead. Like the Pablo Honey record is a good record. It's got a couple songs on it that are really good. But is it the Bends, or is it OK Computer, and is it Kid A? Like that's evolution. That's where, like, so if you were to get into them, say like at OK Computer, and you start working backwards and you get to Pablo Honey, you're like, I don't really hear what I was attracted to with this band, but there's a couple songs. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And there's a million bands like that. That was just the first example that came to mind to where,
Oh, you mean you're not comparing Unbroken to Radiohead? I'm joking. Yeah. Something that I always found really interesting about, what you guys did too, especially with the, you know, aesthetic of the band, not even just the way that you guys are dressing, cause obviously a lot of that, you know, has been spoken about where it's like, oh, you guys look like greasers. It's wild. But the aesthetic and the image of, you know, the logo being consistent and like these things that really were not commonplace. And I know that, you know, Eric was very instrumental in that. Mm-hmm. Was that just basically his idea and he ran with it and everybody was, you know, obviously stoked to do it? Cause I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Like, yeah, but I don't know. I feel like that is really, really uncommon and very difficult for bands to do, even at, in 2023, let alone, you know, 1993.
Eric was very, he was ahead of his time in the sense that he kind of always had a vision, but even there's times I don't think he even understood it himself.
Okay.
And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of tension sometimes too. I mean, he had great ideas, but sometimes they weren't executed in the right way, I suppose, where there was just a lot of like, my way or that's it. I mean, I've got nothing but love for him forever, but you know, we always joke even today, you know, with the Unbroken chats and stuff that we have, we're like, you know, the first time we toured Europe, we would alternate writing the set list. And if he didn't like the set list, he'd literally like take the paper you wrote on and crumple it up and just throw it. So there were, you know, there was a lot to orchestrate and deal with. But he did have a lot of good ideas.
And I know it's difficult like to be able to, you know, probably pinpoint the idea of it's not like he's coming to band practice where it's like, here's the Unbroken logo, guys. Like, you know, check it out. Like, you know, and then being like, yes, we're going to continue this on like all of our merch. And like, this is going to be consistent. And here's my vision board. It's not like, yeah, that language back then.
I mean, the thing about Unbroken is that when we started, and this is why I don't like Ritual. There's a legit reason for this. The OMB Back 7-inch, I have no problem with it. I was 16 years old when we recorded that record. It's our first time doing something. We were so happy to be on New Age, and these are the songs we had at the time. But when we did Ritual, those songs were written, but we were already on to Life of Regret, which was talked about in that 185 podcast. We were already writing for the next record, and Ritual was a forced record. And the thing I hate about it is that it's very cliche in terms of what the lyrics are. It didn't represent us. It doesn't represent really who we are. It was just like your hardcore food groups are represented. You got your, I'm going to be straight edge forever bullshit themed song, because that's a very bold statement to make, saying you're going to be straight edge forever. You've got your animal rights song, you got your racism song, you got your sexism song. It's like the check. All right. Got this one. Check. Got this one. Check. And it doesn't mean those weren't sincere songs, but they weren't original thoughts. They were just kind of regurgitation of what we thought we were supposed to be saying and doing. And that's why I think Life of Regret was so instrumental in getting away from that. And I think that's the relationship that people might have with it, is that, oh, wait, we can talk about something else. We can talk about ourselves, or we can talk about how we're feeling, and not write songs that are about unity and I'm going to be straight edge forever.
The topics that have been covered already, clearly
covered. And this is we started recording Ritual in 1992, and hardcore is literally, 12 years old at that point. It was still like a relatively new thing in the whole, in the big picture of it, looking at it now in 2023, where it's like, okay, this is a 40 plus year old topic. But but these topics were just ad nauseum. It was just like, every band was doing that. Every band looked the same now. Every band was just very formulaic, and that was a turnoff, and it's still a turnoff, And I think, and we realized it. We realized it very early on, this is bunk.
This is not what we want to do.
No,
right?
It's not at all. Especially being a San Diego band,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because it's not like there. Yes, of course, there was elements of where youth crew, whatever, there's bands that would pop up, but not to the point of where it was completely dominate and take over the scene. It was, there was always something different going on in San Diego. So,
yeah. I mean, the straight edge band from San Diego that we looked up to was Amenity. And Amenity was not Youth of Today. They were not Instead. They were not Chain of Strength. They weren't those bands. They were Amenity, and they were heavily influenced by the Bad Brains and just very different. They did not have cliche lyrics. They had very thought provoking lyrics. They're very deep and introspective and very influential on us. And you had Forced Down, and it was, it just wasn't your typical hardcore. And that was our influence. That's what we looked up to.
Sure. Absolutely. And I know that, touring capabilities of Unbroken were always limited to, summer breaks, right, and holidays, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. Did you, enjoy touring, as far as just your personality? Did you enjoy that aspect of it, or are you more at home in a studio?
No, I love being on the road. I love touring. I think it's fun. It's probably one of the things in life I still miss. It would be so much, I wouldn't do it now. It's not possible, but just traveling and just seeing different places and different shows and meeting different people. This, and it's relatable to all of us in the scene, but the relationships and people you've met, you can judge us by your social media friends. How many people you've met from being in a band that's traveled around, that you've built friendships with, that are 20 and 30 years old at this point. It's like that's from touring. That's the relationship of, being in a band and going to different cities and then coming back the next year and seeing the same faces and all that stuff. So yeah, I definitely love touring. I like being in the studio because I like making music, but what I remember most about being in bands is just shows, just being the live aspect of things.
Let us talk about our friends at evilgreed.net. They are an amazing web store solution for record labels and bands all alike. But what does that mean to you as the end user? You go to their website, you can buy stuff from there, vinyl, shirts, sweatshirts, whatever it is you're into, they got it. But I want you to use this discount code, and that gets you 10% off of your entire order, 100 words. And what is cool about Evil Greed is that they kind of act like a record label where they have a very specific point of view. If you're talking about anything artistic slash heavy, that is what they traffic in. Like, they just launched a store from, I would say, legendary black metal artist Lamp of Murmur. They also have a ton of stuff from Blood Incantation, Brutus, one of my favorite bands, Nails, Power Trip, 200 Stab Wounds. And they work with a ton of other cool labels like Triple B Records, Maggot Stomp, Closed Casket Activities. I love what they do. And I was able to hang out with them a couple weeks back, and just hearing how many employees they have, hearing how the company has grown, and they love this partnership. And it warms my soul, because you, the end user, get to benefit in the same way that I benefit from talking about a cool company. So it's great. Use the promo code 100 words. They ship from Berlin, Germany, because that's where their office is located. But the cool thing about it is that the exchange rates are in our favor, and they get stuff out to you very, very fast. Like, I've ordered from them before, and here in California, I've gotten the order in like a week. It's spectacular. So no fear there whatsoever. So go to evilgreed.net, use the promo code 100 words for 10% off your order. Thank you.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like, maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to, like, get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Well, greed.
Kind of on that same tip, the idea of, you know, when you yourself start to notice people paying attention to the band, you know, even if it's like, whatever, someone, hey, our friend is not singing, like, you know, someone up front is like, that we don't know is singing along to our songs. Like, when did you kind of feel some momentum with, you know, Unbroken? Was it, you know, when you had the opportunity to go over to Europe, or was there other moments that stick out in your head when I bring that up?
No, I think after Life of a Brett had come out, I think it started to really resonate, and it became, you know, the shows in San Diego were a little bit better. And then we had a good following up in Orange County too. And those kids would come down and see us play, and they're very fanatical and into it. And it was very, it was bigger, but I wouldn't say that was like big by like standards of the time. I mean, we were not a Victory band. You know, we weren't playing these big clubs or doing these like nice tours. We're still keeping it, not underground by any means, but I mean, like, it just, we weren't mainstream inside the underground. We were still kind of, you know, grassrooting it.
It was a different level.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, I've said this numerous times, but like, Unbroken is bigger in its death than it was in its life. That's a fact. So the first time we toured 93, people did not get us. The second time we toured 94, people kind of listened or paid attention maybe, but they still didn't fully get us. But by 95, they were like, okay, now we get it. And that was our exit, though. That was like, they figured it out when we were on our way out. We knew that we were setting an end date for that in that year. Like, this is the end of the band. So that's about the time it started to kind of, you know, catch on, and people were relating to us, I suppose.
Sure. And I've heard, you know, various numbers or length of time in regards to your actual recording of Life, Love, Regret. And I know it was done a double time. That was literally the reason why Taken recorded it double time as well, besides Blink 182 recording there as well.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm guessing it was obviously just like, you know, oh yeah, here's like $3,000 and we recorded over like 7 days or what was the, if you remember those intimate details.
So Life with Regret, you'll get different stories from different people. What I remember is we paid $650 to record the record.
That's just laughable.
And Rob will tell you, Hartsfield gave him a check for, I think, $1,000, and we gave him back change. Now, sure. I think I've heard him say it was 800. I think I've heard 700. My memory is 650. I'm not saying that's, you know.
Yeah, that's just what your memory.
That's what my memory is. Because we did it in a very, you know, we recorded live. We played, all four of us played the first round of music together. And then Eric and I went and did the guitar overdubs at the same time too. And you can hear it. It got those flaws, but they're intentional and they give it the character it has. It's like, you know, do I want crooked teeth and people know my crooked teeth, or am I going to get braces and just have normal teeth and no one will pay attention to that? And that's kind of what the music is like. Yeah, there's so many flubs in that thing. But I love each and every one. There's nothing on that record I listen to and go, oh, you know, it's flawed by design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think I even remember, it's like, you know, how obsessed, you know, me and my friends were with the record, where it was like, you know, we'd listen to different pans of it on left or right, and then would, you know, hear you guys in the background, like, woo-hoo-hoo, and just like stuff like that, where it was like, oh, this is so like, this is so beautiful, because it's, you know, it's literally humans recording a thing, and not like we could articulate it besides like, we felt like we found an Easter egg or something. But yeah, it's just, you're right. Warts and all, it makes that record obviously special to people.
There's a lot of humor in Unbroken that people don't realize. I mean, anybody that knows Rob Moran knows that he's the class clown. He can make you laugh. He's hilarious. He's a very funny human being. Eric was also very funny. He was very, you know, just our close-knit circle. We laughed all the time. I mean, we're doing pranks and just being goofballs. Right. It wasn't all like, you know, tears and Kleenex. It was very,
totally.
There was a lot of fun. There was a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know that the band, I mean, there's much has been said and documented in regards to, you know, you guys disbanding, as far as, you know, the sounds were evolving and you guys were, you know, getting pulled in different directions, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, your own personal lives are concerned. I'm sure that there has been times where you've thought about like, I wonder what a, you know, full length of, you know, the Fallen Proverbs 7-inch like would have sounded like. I mean, taking the influences that you were, you know, kind of bringing to the table in regards to, you know, Jehu and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that there's been some thought experiments that either you and or other people have talked about in the band to be like, I wonder what that would have sounded like.
That's a good question.
I mean, I know it's impossible to answer, but just like that idea of like the further iteration of that 7-inch, it's like you can see the path, at least in my head.
There was, I mean, Eric had written a couple songs, and I think we played one of them in the last show. And I don't never listen to the vinyl, but I think there's a live recording of one of them. And it was like, I mean, you know, we weren't shy about loving bands like Rocket from the Crypt and stuff. And Eric kind of wrote this song. It was very, an aggressive version of like Rocket, and it wasn't Unbroken. I think the Jehu aspect of it probably would have fit better. When I wrote Fallen Proverb, the intro on guitar is me straight up lifting the idea of the very first song on the first Jehu record. You know, that was like a very huge influence. But the thing about us is that, yeah, we were playing metallic sound, especially Life of the Grid. I think we kind of got away from it with the last few 7-inches, but we were still very punk influenced and noise and chaos. And San Diego was, you know, it's where our hearts are. So it's going to find its way into the sound. And I think that's kind of what was happening. And I don't know. I mean, we didn't spend enough time together to really think about how we were going to, if we were going to do a second LP, what it would be like, or if we were going to keep going with the songs. I think we just kind of knew there was an end date, and that was the end of it. Cause the thing about Unbroken is it was, going back to me being in Julia, like Julia was my main band. Unbroken literally could be considered like my side project. Because like you said earlier, we played vacations, you know, we weren't a band that played, you know, 12 months out of the year. We played 3 months out of the year. And some of that was just touring. And same with Eric. I mean, Eric was in struggle and he was in Swing Kids. And, you know, those were like the main bands. It was so,
right.
To look at Unbroken as like a full-time vehicle was just, it wasn't on anyone's agenda. It was very, very sporadic.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I know that kind of like what you were articulating at the beginning of our chat, where there, you've been able to do more with Unbroken than, you know, you ever would have anticipated in regards to, like you said, the way that people react to your music mm-hmm. now, some, you know, 20, 30 years later. What, you know, shows stick out to you, like, since you have done, you know, many different iterations of, you know, whether it's, you know, playing festivals and going over to Japan, going over to, you know, the UK, like all of those places that you were able to, or actually, no, you guys didn't go to Japan, right?
No, we did. We did.
So yeah, what sticks out to you when I kind of bring that up of just the, you know, places that you never thought you would be?
That right there.
Okay. All of them.
I'm at places I never thought I would be. There was a lot of, you know, obviously shows in the US and shows in Europe where, you know, we've been to Europe, you know, between me, Todd and Rob, especially doing bands after Unbroken, we've been to Europe a handful of times each, touring. And so that was, you know, nothing new, but like, yeah, we got to go to South America. We got to go to Japan, and do, you know, go to those places that we didn't think would happen. But then there was, you know, the magnitude of the shows, I think was crazy. I mean, Rob and I, we didn't have a very tight knit relationship after Unbroken. None of us did. I think we kind of just, you know, me, Todd and Eric kept our friendship going, but Dave, we lost contact. Rob, we just kind of just had separate lives. And throughout the early 2000s, people would kind of bring up like, are you guys going to play again? Would you play again? And I said no every single time. And right. Rob on his own told everyone no. And it was the Burning Fight show that we were asked to play, and I still said no, and Rob still said no.
Right.
And we were swindled. We were tricked because I jokingly said, if Undertow plays, we'll play. And there was a verbal agreement that Undertow would play Burning Fight. I was like, fuck. So
whoops. Damn it.
I literally had to ask somebody for Rob's phone number. I didn't have it, and say, hey, let's talk. And we talked and we're like, yeah, no, we're not doing it. we both like did the pros and cons, and we both found, you know, value in each, and we still said, no, we're not going to do it. And then the Undertow thing was there, and I was like, okay, we'll do it. And then they backed out. And at that point we committed to it, but I did not, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, a 2-day thing at the Metro in Chicago, and we're the headliner on night two, we're going to close it out. Like, I didn't think that would be real. I didn't think that was going to be the caliber of the show. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where, you know, with all due respect to like Converge, they played before us, you know, out of respect, and which is really awesome of them. They're great, great people. I didn't know we were that band. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that we would be Jim Grimes, who booked the show. One of the things that's crazy, and this totally is just a memory I always have, was he came out to do a speech and introduce us. And he didn't say, here's Unbroken, or, you know, whatever. He said, they're here.
Right.
And I thought that was so strange. It's like the kid who, you know, the aliens are here. They're here. Like they're here. I did it. I'm the guy that got them to come back and play.
Right.
Yep. And I, you know, I didn't know, you know, and then to book the Glass House show and sell it out within the first hour of tickets being on sale. It's like, really? Yeah. That just happened.
Right. That,
you know, like,
and I mean, honestly, and for this is me just blowing smoke up your butt right now, but just like, I mean, I was fortunate enough to see, I didn't see you when you guys were originally around, but saw you at the Eric Allen show. And then basically, you know, almost every was at a Burning Fight, all that sort of stuff. The thing that I always took away with, I mean, you guys could have sounded like absolute dog crap, and I probably would have been like, it doesn't matter. This is so good. But like, you took the assignment seriously. And I know that sounds like stupid to say, because now bands, like, you know, every band is reunited and played shows and whatever. But like, you didn't have to like take it as seriously as you guys did, but you did. And I think that that's what, you know, really
resonated, and also the fact that, you know, whether or not you were, you know, extremely active in playing in bands, you guys were all active, you know, and playing shows and doing stuff. And I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, I play guitar every day. I've been playing every day. I was joking with the Unbroken group text that we have, like saying, I don't think I'm going to practice the songs till I get to San Diego. And it's not because I need to warm up on guitar. I'm fresh on guitar. I just, the Unbroken songs, I don't have to think about them. I can play them anytime, anywhere. Like they're, right. I don't have to focus and relearn. They're just there. I will always know how to play those songs. And that was kind of the sarcasm going, I'm just going to show up and play. I'm just going to get to San Diego. We'll have our first rehearsal. And that will be the first time that I play these songs, because I'm going to play them without thinking. They're just going to come right out. They're that natural and a part of who I am that it will be completely normal for me to play them like I'm speaking the English language to you right now. It just comes out. There's no premeditated statement. They just flow right out of me. And that's the band.
Yeah, totally. And on that point too, like you were mentioning, the fact that, you know, you still were really active with music, obviously after Unbroken, with, you know, Kill Holiday, Crush on You. And like you know, even though, like you said, there were many years where you were just like, you know, kind of nascent and you were really paying attention to either what was happening, mm-hmm. you know, within the quote unquote scene or what have you. And now that you have obviously, you know, dipped back in and, you know, done a lot of things and still create music, what keeps you connected? Like, cause I mean, clearly, like, you don't need to, like, there are other things that are very fulfilling in your life, but you know, what keeps you, I guess, moving on with, you know, the music creation and playing in bands and all that sort of stuff?
I have to, I mean, I write songs. I'm a songwriter and I make up shit every time I pick up a guitar. It doesn't mean they're going to be songs you'll hear, but I'm always creating something. And I think there's a few different levels of people who play music. And I think there are those who can hold an instrument and make it make sounds. And then there's people who can craft things, you know, and I look at myself in some way, and not to have a big head. It's, you know, this isn't like a pretentious thing. I'm not trying to be that way, but like, I am a song composer where I write everything. I hear songs when I'm playing guitar. I don't just hear the guitar that's being played to me. I hear the drums. I hear how the vocals are going to go and the bass parts. Like, this is like in my head, I'm already writing the whole thing when I'm first come up with the first few riffs. I have to get that out. That has to be, you know, I have to release it. I have to make it into something. And that's just kind of just the way I'm wired. So
yeah, that's what keeps you connected. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I guess part of that as well, where when people started to, you know, reflect their, you know, influence on the fact that, you know, the reason that they got into hardcore or whatever was all, you know, kind of rooted in the music that you have been a part of. What were some of the, I guess, like unexpected places or, you know, people sharing their experiences with you that you were just like, what? Like, you know, whether it's a specific, you know, band. I mean, you don't have to, you know, name anybody if you don't want to, but just like those places where things echoed back to you that you never thought would ever happen.
I think that would have to be with just being overseas, you know, going to, especially South America. Those kids are extremely passionate, and not to say that anybody else is not. But you look at certain countries and think like, how the fuck did my music get there?
Sure.
You know, my wife makes fun of me all the time. She goes, internationally famous Stephen Andrew Miller, because sure. I can literally say to somebody, people all over the world listen to music I've written. But it's not like people all over the world listen to music, like, you know, with this bravado. It's just like, holy shit, I've done something that somebody, you know, when you look at doing music, you look at starting bands, you don't have, you have an agenda, maybe you might have some expectation, but you don't really know where it's going to go. And it's almost like a lottery ticket. And the fact that like you've done something that, you know, especially in your teens, you're making music, and then you find that it gets released and people all over the country and then in other countries, start to dig it and relate to it and love it. It's still mind blowing. It's insane. Like, and you wouldn't, I mean, without social media, you wouldn't know to the extent that this stuff exists. Right. That's definitely a tool in aiding people to, you know, to contact you or to show you, yeah, I live in Singapore and I love Unbroken, or I live in Chile and I love Unbroken. Like, it's, you know, that's just, it's crazy. It's still crazy. It's always going to be crazy. You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It will never stop being insane that happens. Mm-hmm. I know that you had this kind of the last thing I wanted to pick your brain on was, you know, you moved away from Southern California, and mm-hmm. that I'm sure was a big experience because, you know, when you're raised in Southern California, it's always like, okay, like I didn't imagine living in other places. And,
right.
being, like you mentioned previously, a dad and obviously a family man and, you know, all of the other things that fill your life. How does it feel to be, you know, kind of away from California and kind of, you know, building a life somewhere different than what you had previously known?
It's odd. I'm homesick for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll just go on record. My biggest complaint is
sure.
being vegan in an area where there's not any vegan.
Right. Sure.
So, you know, in San Diego, it's like, oh, I've got so many places I can go eat right now. I don't want to make dinner tonight. I'm going to go to Evolution. I'm going to go, hey, let's go eat at Rancho's. Like just all these things as to where here. I mean, I cook a lot and that's fine, but there's no, you know, we're spoiled. We were spoiled in San Diego and we're spoiled here too. I mean, I work in an office only 2 days a week, 3 days a week. I work from home. So making dinner is not the end of the world.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was an economic decision first and foremost to leave San Diego. By the time that we were ready to start shopping houses, we were priced out of the market. It was, you know, you got to make six figures and that first figure should be a three if you're going to buy a house there that, you know, is in a good spot to raise a family. And, you know, we were making good money, but it was still like, you know, I have a nice house here. And the joke is I pay less than my mortgage and I was paying to rent a 950 square foot apartment in San Diego.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we first got here and people are like, wait, you're from San Diego and you voluntarily moved here to Connecticut. What's wrong with you? And
right.
I just break it down and go, look, you know, there's, you know, it's an economic thing. There was no way we were going to do it there, what we can do here. And like the school system that my son's involved in is phenomenal. I mean, I couldn't ask for something better. It's just, you know, we're in a smaller town. Taxes here are high for here, but I'm a Californian. So when people
complain, everything's going to be lower.
Yeah. When people complain about taxes here, I'm like, oh, really? Let's talk about this. Cause Connecticut has a flat state tax of 6.35, you know? And I said, hey, you know, in California, your taxes vary on your zip code. So let's not go there and talk about how rough it is. So property tax here is high, but then I see the school and all that. And I'm like, okay, well, it's totally worth it, you know, as to where I could pay an insane amount in property tax in San Diego and just be like, well, what do I see out of this? You know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you know, this as a parent, like your life is no longer about yourself. It's your children, you know, you're raising them. It's them. You're giving them the best you can do. And it's not about you. And, you know, it's crazy because we moved here and I thought, you know, for sure I was done playing music. I was just going to, you know, focus on career and home life and family. And I still managed to meet people and get a band going and,
yep.
and have that going as well. So it's like, you know, the normality of my situation. I have an amazing job that I never would have gotten in San Diego. I work in the industry of music and my job is not like work in that sense.
Sure.
It's very like, oh, I love what I do. I have a nice home and everybody here is happy. Like I said, I brought the negative out of the gate, which is just the vegan food. There's no,
totally right. Right.
No convenient vegan food for me. I got to make everything. So,
right.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Well, no, it's cool. And I just, the reason I ask is definitely just because the, you know, when you have experienced so much of one particular city and area and then to, you know, supplant yourself somewhere else that is, you know, so drastically different. Like, it has to be a culture shock in some respects.
You, Orange County is a culture shock.
No, it's true. It's very.
I live there. True. I lived there for 9 years. Like, right, like that's when people ask about Southern California, I always tell them, like, there's San Diego, there's Orange County, and there's Los Angeles, and yep. all three are not the same. It's right. it's a different vibe in each place, and Orange County is a very interesting place.
Yep.
I don't hate it. I don't love it. I don't have fond memories. I don't have bad memories, but it's just kind of like, it's so very bland. And the reason being is that it's a collective group of cities. So there's no like, there's no downtown. There's no culture. There's no like, hey, we're going to go here. As to where like San Diego, you've got Hillcrest downtown. Like, you have places to go that are very different, and you get to experience different things. As to where like, well, I don't really want to go to South County. You know, they got nice beaches, but the people there suck. Newport. Yeah. I don't really want to do that either.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, not to by any means rip on those arrays there, cause I'm not. But it's very, you know, it's very conservative. It's very,
It's definitely a bubble atmosphere that exists within.
Yes,
yeah. For, yes. No, it's totally true. And like, regardless of where a person lands on the political spectrum, if they have never broadened their scope beyond Orange County and, or, you know, occasional dips into Los Angeles or San Diego. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely, it's that their reality is 4 inches in front of their nose.
And I lived in a lot of different places. I did Costa Mesa. I did Huntington. I spent two years in Anaheim Hills.
Yeah.
And then I lived, the majority of my time was in Orange, and I love Orange. I do. I miss Orange. Like, I do love that. So, that's a home. That's a second home to me.
So that is that. I could have gone on for another like 2 hours just on life, love, regret, but I'm not going to do that, you know? And I really, it also made me laugh and chuckle when he was like, oh yeah, Ritual. Yeah. That's not a very good record. I'm like, yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I don't like Ritual either, but Unbroken's one of my favorite bands of all time. It's funny how that can work out, but really, really appreciate Steve hanging out with me. And like I said, you need to listen to Unbroken's entire discography minus Ritual and maybe the first 7-inch. Everything else they've done is just chef's kiss. Like, well, actually, I can't even describe what's better than a chef's kiss, but that's what Unbroken is. So, and Steve is just a very prolific musician. He's always working on stuff, and I love to see that because, you know, his fire hasn't been extinguished, and I really enjoy that because I want to be there myself as well. Anyways, next week I have a friend of the show, a person who I've had on before, but I am incredibly excited to welcome him back, Scott Lee. He is a manager. He is a owner of a few companies that do a lot of stuff within the music industry, whether it's merch, ticketing, all that sort of stuff. But what I had him on about is the relaunch of the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival. I'm excited because I'm going to go out there, do a few live podcasts. It'll be really, really fun. But it's the relaunch of this storied festival in Worcester, Massachusetts. I realized that for a while I was saying Worcester, trying to like act like a, you know, a Bostonian, and that was not actually how you say it. So regardless, the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival is back in action 2 days, Friday and Saturday, the 17th and 18th of September. So I wanted to pick Scott's brain about it. So that's what we do next week. And until then, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.